Hello and welcome to Preoccupied. Today we're going to be talking to Dr. Daniel Weissman from the University of Michigan, a cognitive psychologist and attention researcher.
So listen up.
Yes, pay attention to our talking about attention.
Yeah. So one of the most jarring things that we found when we were getting ready for this interview, getting ready for this episode, was people can be really blind to their surroundings when they're in the zone.
Yeah. So take a look in the description. There is a YouTube link to a selective attention experiment. And if you can't see the description for whatever reason, feel free to look up on YouTube selective attention experiment.
It's the first video that comes up.
Yep. About 21 million views on there right now.
For good reason.
Yes. It's a rather fun experiment. So pause this podcast, go watch that experiment and see how you do, and then come back.
Yeah, we'll be here.
Yep. So I'm going to wait just a minute.
So welcome back.
Yep.
If you opted out of participating in that little experiment, what you might have seen was the following video. So somebody says, hey, look at all the people in the white t-shirts and look at how many times they pass around this ball. Try to count it. So your brain is like, all right, I'm there. This is what I do. I count things.
Yep.
And then about halfway through, you're thinking, okay, 11, 12,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah, you know, there's these people in the white shirts and the people in the black shirts. And you're only supposed to count the people in the white shirts who are passing the ball, you know, bouncing on the ground and everything.
Right. And then if you're like, Zenon and I, you get halfway through the video and you notice a gorilla, or no, not a gorilla, a man in a gorilla suit walks right through the middle of these people tossing around this ball.
Stops right in the middle, you know, kind of beats his chest, continues onwards.
It's a little roar maybe. And I got halfway through it and I asked Zena, I was like, is this like, are you trolling me? I was like, why is there a gorilla in there? And apparently...
Yeah, the thing is, in that video, something to the tune of 57% of participants did not see the gorilla.
Over half did not see this man come into the middle of this hodgepodge of people in t-shirts, beat his chest, and walk mosey on off because they were so focused on counting how many times this ball was passed between the white t-shirts.
Yep, exactly. And it kind of speaks to our inability to see things that we don't expect.
Yeah.
And that was replicated in another study where they took the same concept. And what they did was they put people in front of security camera feeds. And they said, okay, pay attention to these security camera feeds. You know, let us know if anything out of the ordinary happens. And they used both just normal people and trained, experienced security professionals and received the same results from both. People were more likely to see a man in a uniform walk in and set down a box than they were to notice a man in a pirate suit with an eye patch and hat and hook and parrot on his shoulder walk in and swing his sword around.
So which they're more likely... I personally feel much less safe in my local mall now.
Yes.
After that experiment.
Because, yeah, they noticed the box but not the pirate.
Yeah. This is what we call inattentional blindness, and this is what cognitive psychologists study, among a lot of other things.
Yeah. Cognitive psychology kind of focuses on how we take in information and process and store it.
Yeah. So, how we problem solve.
How
we remember things.
Yep. Things like sensation, attention, perception. Short-term memory, long-term memory, recall, all those sorts of things are things that cognitive psychologists study.
Yeah, so it's very broad, but most of these things happen inside of our prefrontal cortexes, which is the last bit of brain we've got above other animals, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, ours is significantly larger, and a lot of people say that it's that part of the brain that makes humans human. It's, you know, kind of right up in your forehead. And it's also the last part of your brain to develop. So when you hear people saying that your brain isn't fully developed until you're 25 years old, that's what they're talking about, is your prefrontal cortex.
Right. You know, if your mom keeps saying, Maddie, why do you make such poor decisions? You can say, hey, mom, my prefrontal cortex isn't even totally developed where all of my decision-making processes happen.
Exactly.
How am I supposed to know where my wallet is at all times?
Exactly. And the processes that the prefrontal cortex is responsible for, we call those executive function. That's something that's going to come up later, I think, in the interview. And that involves things like short-term memory, weighing different pieces of information against each other in decision-making, and inhibition of impulses, which is why you get a lot of young people doing a lot of misguided things.
Yeah. But specifically what we are focusing on today is going to be attention. And this is something that I personally am quite interested in because of my lack of it. Utterly. Just. Attention basically, well, William James, one of the first psychologists in America, how he put it is that attention implies withdrawal from some things in order to deal effectively with others. So maybe, you know, kind of pushing some other things to the side to be able to have your full focus on whatever task is at hand.
So one way in which we see this is something that we call the cocktail party effect. And that's where, you know, you're in a room with a bunch of people and everyone's talking, but you're able to focus in on one conversation that you want to be paying attention to and exclude all of those other conversations from your perception. And that's something that we even see in animals. So, for example, in penguins, you hear that one mom penguin is able to hear her baby penguin out of all the other baby penguins chirping. That's that same effect at play, is the mom is able to hear that baby penguin's chirp to the exclusion of all others.
Something else that sometimes goes along with the cocktail party effect is if you are in that crowded room of people, you know, and then somebody says your name from across the room. I know many a time I could be causing, like, did you hear my name? I could have sworn I heard my name. No? Okay. That was weird. And like you totally lose your train of thought because you thought something, a series of sounds that has very much significance to you was produced in some area over there. You want to know who's talking shit, you know?
Exactly. So, you know, some things can break through your inattentional blindness.
Yes. But the extent of our selective attention, we're pretty good at it. So there's something called the, like, dichotic listening research. So if you're a participant in this, you're going to go to the lab, whatever. You're going to put on your phones. And in one ear, let's say in your left ear, there's a story about a camping trip. And then in your right ear, there's a story about George Washington. And these are going on at the same time. But the researcher is going to ask you to just pay attention to the camping trip story in your left ear. And let's say this researcher then says, okay, so you're paying attention to the camping trip story, just repeat everything in the message as it comes, which is called shadowing. So participants were able to shadow the message really well. Not too surprising. But when asked about the other message, the George Washington message, they couldn't recall much of anything beyond just the pitch of the speaker's voice. So all of that great cherry tree chopping action totally went out the window, was not taken in at all. And in even later studies, they were wondering, like, okay, how much will people not pay attention to? And even when the George Washington story, the one that isn't being paid attention to in this experiment, even when the language changed from English to German, or if they said the same word 30 times, the participant did not register those changes because they were so focused on the camping trip story. And this shows that stimuli that aren't paid attention to don't get that second layer of processing.
Yep. And as always, you can find links to all of this amazing research in the description.
Yes.
So another thing that we talk about a lot with attention is multitasking. And, you know, you'll see in a lot of places that multitasking is just the new way to go. Like, this is how humans are going to become even more productive, as we're going to hone our multitasking capability right. to its finest.
I mean, like, I'm sure that a lot of people who are listening right now are not just sitting there with their hands folded in their lap listening to our podcast, you know, oh, nodding, kind of looking around the room, interesting. You know, they're probably driving or eating or working out. I know some people listen to podcasts while they work out. And we definitely live in a multitasking world. I mean, look, we have our smartphones, you know, we have textbooks and listening to music and also eating, you know, for the student life anyway.
Yeah.
So it's definitely a world where multitasking is more available, maybe more necessary than ever.
Yeah. But what cognitive research tells us is that when it comes down to it, the mind can really only focus on one thing at a time. You can really only put your attention in one place. And when you're switching between a couple things that require your attention, really what's happening is exactly that. You're switching your attention. It's not really possible to focus on two things. Although, if you're doing one thing that requires your attention, like listening to this podcast, hopefully, and another that doesn't, like maybe driving or washing the dishes. Not those don't require attention.
Please pay attention while you drive.
Yes, please.
Disclaimer.
Yeah, don't distracted drive by focusing only on our podcast.
Yeah, don't be taking notes while you're on the freeway, right?
Exactly. Yeah. But it requires less attention for most people than, say, listening to a podcast full of new information.
Exciting information.
Yeah.
So these things that are more automatic, you know, like, say, jogging or going on a walk or, you know, driving is definitely something that gets to be pretty automatic. Your brain might be able to, okay, keep an eye on the road and also listen to this new song. But when we multitask with things like, let's say, writing a paper and watching Netflix at the same time, then you'll find that your results come about much slower and also of a lower quality or lesser quality, which I'm sure many of professors and students alike can attest to.
Yep. And you also don't take in very much of the Netflix either. So,
right. You know, you're kind of like double wasting your time. Yeah.
Exactly. You get to the end and you've absorbed none of the Netflix and finished none of the paper.
So while attention is kind of like a resource that you can use up throughout the day, I'm sure you, by the time you get to the end of the day, all you want to do is turn your brain off and watch television rather than indulge in one of the great novels of our time or something like that.
Or listen to an engaging podcast.
It's something that you can build kind of like a muscle. And there are a lot of ways that have been shown to improve your attention. So things like meditation or mindfulness that kind of bring you into the moment, make you very aware, those kinds of things.
Yeah. Activities by which you are actively focusing your attention on something that otherwise it may be difficult to focus on.
Exactly. And while you might be running out of attention for that day by doing this, you're kind of building up your stamina in a way.
Yeah. And then because attention consumes energy, you can always restore some with, you know, some nice sleep or, you know, maybe a meal.
Exactly. And that's actually another thing that you can do to, in the short term, to improve your attention. If you know you have a big lecture that day or something, get lots of sleep and pay attention to your nutrition, what you're eating, staying hydrated.
Yep. And although caffeine does a lot of nasty things to your brain, it does increase your alertness and attention. So if that's something you need to do, what it actually does is it attaches to the same receptors as the neurotransmitters that cause attention. So that's part of how caffeine works on your brain and your dose of biological psych for the day.
Yeah. So luckily, you won't need to strain too much to listen in on this next interview we have with Dr. Daniel Weissman. He has some really interesting stories to tell us and some fascinating research going on. So with no further ado, Dr. Daniel Weissman.
And dolphins.
So we're here with Dr. Weissman, is it? Okay. So we're here with Dr. Weissman today at the University of Michigan, Ann Arbor. Dr. Weissman, could you briefly describe your background and your education?
Gosh, let's see. I have a degree in physics and a degree in psychology. And people told me I was crazy, actually, for getting both those degrees. They didn't see how I could ever put them together. But then I went to graduate school and studied cognitive neuroscience and learned how to do functional MRI studies of the brain while people thought and paid attention and used other psychological abilities and kind of mixed them, those two things, together. I went on and did a postdoc at Duke University and did a lot more with functional neuroimaging there before coming to Ann Arbor in 2006.
Wow, that's very cool. What drew you to both psychology and physics as an undergraduate?
Well, it was kind of sequential. So, you know, I was always writing short stories that I would sell for a quarter when I was a kid about, like, you know, inventing stuff and, you know. And so I wanted to be a kind of physicist or something in the hard sciences. And then after about 3 years of having gone through a physics and basically completing all the required classes except for a gen ed class, I thought to myself, I want to do something more related to people. And I enjoyed the quantitative side, but I thought I wanted to just think about something more related to people. So I started looking around. I took a bunch of classes one semester, the first semester of my fourth year, drama. I took economics. I took social psychology, and I thought that was the one. My TA, Andrea Hopmeyer from Canada, kept running into the classroom. She was a first-year grad student going, I'm only one chapter ahead of you guys. And she just made the class really interesting, and she had a Canadian accent, which was cool. And then and I was like, okay, this is the profession for me, not really necessarily the most, you know, intuitive way. And then I had an argument with the dean who said at Illinois, who said, you have to be out of here in 4 years, so in your final semester, you have to take this one general education requirement that you haven't taken so far and graduate with your physics degree. And I said, yeah, but I think I really want to go into psychology. No, you have to do this. So I just didn't. And I started taking all these psych classes, but none of them counted cleverly for the gen ed requirement. So then the dean got angry with me at the end of the semester, but I found a friendlier dean to sign an extension paper for me so I could stay an extra year and get the psych degree. One other interesting, potentially, for your listeners, is this, you know, after I finished, maybe because I'd switched in the middle, I wasn't really sure if I still, you know, would like psychology as a profession. You know, I thought, oh, that's interesting in class. When I get a grade for it, I'll do it, but do I really care? So I went to Hawaii, and I was an intern in the Kualoa Basin Marine Mammal Laboratory at the University of Hawaii, and I got to train dolphins. And I was
heard about that, psychologists being with training animals.
Yeah, and so I played with dolphins all day. I helped graduate students do cognitive psychology experiments in dolphins, like teaching them gestures that they could understand. Like, my project was teaching the word and, like, to a dolphin in its gestural language. Like, do this and do that, you know. And that took some time. But they could do all kinds of crazy things. Like, we could show them an object above the water and then put two objects underneath the water that were in boxes that they couldn't see through, but they could sonar, you know, echolocate through.
Yeah.
And they could tell us with 90% accuracy which box contained the object that I had shown them originally outside the water.
Wow.
Actually, yeah. So it was a really interesting experience working on these sorts of projects. And then that convinced me that, yes, I really did want to go to psychology graduate school, because my mentor there, my graduate student mentor, was named Chris Prince. And he was Canadian, too. You see, there's a Canadian influence. And he would always, you know, oftentimes at the end of the day, say to me something like, what do you think the dolphin is thinking about? You know how Canadians pronounce that word. What's it thinking about, Daniel? And I would say, I don't know. Does he understand language? And that's, Chris would say, that's what we have to find out. And how will we design the experiment to figure out if the dolphin understands? And sometimes I thought the dolphin really did understand or have a concept of these words and the gestures, but sometimes they didn't. So, for example, one day, and just stop me at any moment. One day we were doing an experiment and we were asking the dolphin if various objects were present in the tank. And there was a yes paddle and a no paddle. And the dolphin would go to the yes paddle if the object was in the tank and to the no paddle if it wasn't. And so there was a speaker that we kind of pushed into the tank. It was floating. And it was just sort of, you know, it was kind of big. So we had it tied with a rope to the side of the tank so we could easily pull it back in. And I was training the dolphin. And I said, well, is there a speaker in the tank? Kept going to the no paddle. Eventually got very pissed off, wasn't getting its fish, I couldn't feed it, you know, wrong answer. And it turned out that a professor came out, Professor Lewis Herman, who was the PI of that lab, and explained that when the dolphin was trained what it means for an object to be inside of the tank, it was trained that if anything is attached to the outside of the tank, it's not actually in the tank.
Wow.
And that was another experience that made me really think to myself, you know, how do we know what an animal, a human, is thinking and understands? And here, you know, when I think of something being inside of a tank, it doesn't matter if it's tied with a rope to the side of the tank. It's still, if, you know, if I put my dog on a leash inside a swimming pool, which I like to do at the end of the summer, if I have a long leash and I attach it to the side so I can pull it back and it doesn't drown, it's still in the pool, but not to the dolphin. Dolphin's like, no, that's not, you know. So it really got me thinking about, well, how do I even know how a human thinks? If a human responds yes or no in an experiment, do I really know that it understands? Could it be using some other rule to respond that isn't quite reflecting the same concept that I think? And how would I design an experiment to figure that out?
Yeah.
And that really, I think, influenced me in a strong way.
So is that when you first felt that spark for cognitive psychology specifically? You said you enjoyed your social psych classes and your other ones.
I think, yeah. So I think I was feeling a lot of sparks for a lot of different classes. I think even when I went to graduate school, I was studying cognitive neuroscience. So I had an interest in neuroscience as well as in cognition. But I think, I think I had a lot of interests. And I think what has fueled me a lot is the ability to design experiments that isolate some process of interest. Sometimes the experiment can isolate a pattern of brain activity that's interesting. Other times it can isolate a pattern of behavior that's interesting, right? And so for me, I think both those are very cool and I'm interested, but the act of designing the experiment and forming my hypotheses and thinking how will I distinguish often between two hypotheses, the dolphin understands what it means to be in a tank like I do, or it actually thinks that anything tied by a rope or touching the side of the tank isn't in the tank. How would I design an experiment? And what, you know, what the professor did, the professor, Lewis Herman, he came out, he said, oh, it's this thing with the rope, you know? And we were like, how do you know? He said, let me show you. He pulls the speaker back in, unties it from the side of the tank, throws it back in the middle of the pool. And I was like, oh my God, you know, so I was scared even by that. And dolphins are swimming around and stuff. And he says, now ask the dolphin in its gestural language if there's a speaker in the pool. And I did, and it went right to the yes paddle.
Wow.
And so it's this idea, like, you know, designing an experiment to really distinguish between two things. I think that became something I really got sparks going. And for that, it didn't really matter what the content was, right? It could be social psychology, it could be cognitive psychology, it could be neuroscience. But as long as there are two kind of views of a phenomenon or two hypotheses that I can design an experiment to distinguish, I think that really fuels me.
So it's like the problem solving that really drew you in.
Yeah, I mean, there is also, I mean, of course, some problems are more interesting to solve than
yeah.
others. So it's not that I have no specific domain of interest. I actually study attention and higher level control over behavior, how humans can, for example, minimize distraction from irrelevant stimuli. What strategies do we use? Also, how can we be flexible? Like right now, I notice you're staring at me intently. But if I say something unexpected, you'll probably adapt what you ask me next or do something. And how are you doing that? Like you have this goal that you want to conduct this interview, but if something strange happens, you'll adapt and keep it going for as long as you can, unless I go completely crazy and start bouncing off the walls, right? Which could happen. I'm not guaranteeing it. Well, but the point is that we can adapt in a lot of amazing ways. And these are all examples of sort of how we control our behavior at very high levels. And that's what I'm really interested in.
Yeah.
Okay. kind of curious. So you talked about all this research with dolphins and stuff. And I don't know, this may be getting a bit outside the scope of this interview, but briefly, what do you think is the difference between humans and animals in cognition?
Oh, wow. Gosh. Well, I think it obviously depends on the animal.
Yeah.
Right. So there are certain animals that are just more like humans, you know, so they're chimpanzees and certain kinds of animals that really are similar to us. On the other hand, there are animals that we would say are dissimilar to us, you know, like mice or rats or something, but with which we share huge, almost an overwhelming majority of our genetic code is similar to a rat.
Right.
So
what's that difference between
human
and another?
Yeah. So what's that difference? Well, that's a really good question. To me, I think it depends on the animal, but I also think, you know, humans, of course, have this enormous prefrontal cortex, and I think that has enabled our species to be more reflective, use these higher level kinds of strategies to govern our behavior. We might be far less stimulus driven, you know, so imagine like, you know, I have a bulldog / pit bull mix. This is why I'm wearing this t-shirt, see, for pit's sake.
Right? Love it, yeah.
And, you know, my pit bull, when she sees, a rabbit across the street, she goes crazy and she wants to run after the rabbit, attack the rabbit, and she really has trouble, you know, inhibiting herself. That may not be characteristic of all pit bulls. Maybe it's just mine. But I do think that the prefrontal cortex is useful for those higher level abilities, such as inhibition. That's one example. Or multitasking or things like that.
So then, after all of that education and through the cognitive neuroscience, and now you're at the University of Michigan. So what is it you do here?
So let's see. I do really three things. One is I do this research on attention and higher level control over behavior. And I have a laboratory where mixtures of undergraduate, graduate students, we work together on different projects to investigate cognitive and neural mechanisms underlying that. I also teach classes, so I teach a large undergraduate course that introduces students to functional MRI methodology and how to use that to figure out how different parts of the brain contribute to cognition. I also teach graduate courses. I've taught classes in attention and cognitive control or higher level control like within my research area, but also methods classes on functional MRI. And I also do service. So service might be things like this last couple of years, I was on the governing body of the department, which made tenure decisions, promotion decisions. We decide important aspects of department policy. I also ran a weekly talk series where we have a speaker come in each week and they talk about their research to our area of the department. So it's really a mixture of these research, teaching, and service
right.
kinds of things.
So I guess, what part of your workday is the most fun?
Gosh. What part of my workday is the most fun? There's, I guess, a few things. I really like writing, and actually my research methods class for undergrads is an upper-level writing course, and that's partly because I really like writing. So I like writing papers, I like thinking about hypotheses like I talked about before, designing experiments, analyzing the data to see what's true. For me, it's like a puzzle, and I want to figure out the answer to this puzzle. That's probably the most exciting part of my day. That happens in the writing context. Another big part of it is my lab meetings, where we have a mixture of graduate and undergraduate students, and I really take the apprenticeship model, so I like to teach undergraduates how to think like me. And so it's not just like, okay, you know, be a slave grunt laborer in my lab. It's like, become a little scientist like me, you know, become crazy like me. And I feel like that's really fun for me to try to help others do that. Another thing which is related is when I teach classes, I also really enjoy trying to encourage people to think in these ways. And if I don't, it's funny, when I'm teaching, if I'm not totally prepared, I feel a little bit nervous. But if it's a lecture or a subject that I've talked about quite a bit, I can ham it up.
Yeah.
And I really like that. I do Yoda imitations. I do, you know, like a movie character, TV character imitations to keep the students awake because they fall asleep. It's methods. It's boring or something.
Right.
But I do a lot of that stuff, and that's really fun. Also.
Right. As somebody
yeah.
who researches attention, I'm sure you get pretty creative with maintaining.
Yeah.
Let's see. So what kind of research are you working on now?
So now I'm working on studies that look at how we can remain flexible and in the context of minimizing distraction, but also more generally. And actually, it's funny that you asked me that because I guess we only have a microphone here, but most cognitive psychologists or cognitive neuroscientists even, when they record how quickly people react to stimuli, they use keyboards like this, just normal computer keyboards. And recently I created this force sensitive keyboard, and it's kind of just got a few keys on it. I can bring it over here so I can speak into the microphone, but it's only got a few keys on it. The F, G, J, K, and N keys here. But in addition to actuating, you can hear it click. Hear that? Yeah. but it also, if you just barely touch one, just a teeny, teeny bit, it knows exactly how hard you're pushing. And the way it works is that it basically can record less than a gram, or about a gram, a little less than a gram of pressure on each key. So it sends a digital signal when you push it all the way down, just like your normal computer keyboard when you type, sends
right.
a signal. And But this, even if you're just thinking, should I push this key, like anticipating what's going to happen next, this will record that. And so recently we published a paper that's coming out in a journal called Psychonomic Bulletin and Review, in which we show that people are adapting to recent events that have occurred in an experiment and anticipating that future events will kind of resemble those previous events that just occurred, which is completely illogical. Because why? Because in our experiments, we randomize the nature of the events. So there's no way you can predict anything. And yet, you know how people often see patterns in randomness? Like, why when I look up in the sky, do I see a face in that cloud?
Yeah.
Why is that happening? Well, the same reason that the human brain is looking for patterns in randomness in the real world allows us to pick that up with these force sensitive keyboards. And we're using that to just basically see what is the brain predicting what's going to happen next. We also do experiments. I collaborate with David Brang in our department, who studies actually multisensory processing and integration. So right now you're listening to me speak and you're attending really much better than any of the students in my class do. But you're probably integrating my lip movements with my voice.
Mm-hmm.
And so how does the brain do that? So David studies a lot of that. And he also records electrical signals directly from the brain in patients with epilepsy and who are getting operations to get tumors removed. And so we can look inside the brain and record its activity while people perform tasks like the ones I do or the ones he does, and try to figure out how different parts of the brain contribute to multisensory processing or to attention and cognitive control or to other abilities.
Wow, that's awesome.
So then does cognitive psychology try to address a lot of those questions that come about, like you were talking earlier with the dolphins? Like, is it that they don't know the speaker's there, or that they don't know how to answer my question the way I want them to? So does cognitive psychology kind of try to address a lot of those underlying things that maybe just a question won't get at?
Well, cognitive psychology actually often is very concerned with, well, broadly it's concerned with understanding cognition, right? How we think. But cognitive psychologists, I think, at least me, if I call myself that, cognitive psychologists, I think, pride themselves on being able to design experiments that really isolate a process of interest. So the idea would be that, how can I put this? In many experiments, when we study a phenomenon, there could be multiple causes. Let me give you a great example. Tuition goes up every year at college. Why? If I asked you why, what would you say? What's the reason it goes up?
Inflation.
Okay.
That was what I thought at first.
Inflation. Is there
more
anything?
More demand.
Okay, so there's more than one reason it goes up? So there's inflation and demand, or it's just one or the other?
Both.
Okay, what
why
else?
Not?
What other reasons do you think tuition goes up?
Expansions, university, construction.
Maybe they use that. Right. So there could be many reasons why tuition goes up, right? So in the same way, there can be many things going on in a person's brain. Or when I minimize distraction from an irrelevant stimulus, I could use many ways to do that. What are some ways? If you were like blinking at me now during this interview, I could close my eyes, and that would be a good way. But if she started humming, I'd have to cover my ears. And pretty soon I'd be, not able to see or hear, and that would be very ineffective for me. But the point is that any given experiment might actually measure more than one thing that could contribute to the phenomenon that you're interested in, memory or attention, et cetera. And so cognitive psychologists are known and renowned for trying to isolate the contributions of separate things to the phenomenon that they're studying. Right now, Professor Weissman is minimizing distraction using this strategy, but not that one. Or right now, Professor Weissman is multitasking and juggling between different activities. And there's three different ways you can multitask. And our experiment shows that he's using this way and not that way. And so that's something that, yeah, like getting back to the question about the dolphin, that's something that cognitive psychologists really try to do. Not often with dolphins because they eat a lot of fish and I don't have a big tank here.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, we try to isolate these contributions of different things.
That is really exciting.
So, you see in like, you know, different articles and things, people talking about how like there's kind of like as a society, our attention span is becoming shorter and shorter. Do you see that reflected in your research or in your research that you read?
Yeah. So actually, Melina Unkefer, who is a researcher at UCSF, has done some studies trying to look at whether the tendency for people to multitask makes it harder for them to focus on any one thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out that I think she's been uncovering some evidence. I'm not familiar with the most up-to-date studies that she's done, but I think that's something she's looking at, and that there was some evidence, at least preliminarily, to support that view. Personally, what I see in my own daily life is the increasing use of smartphones. And so in my classes, when I teach undergraduates, my rule is, you know, there's no electronic equipment. So they can't bring laptops to class. They can't bring, and if they do, I just tell them, like, we'll just reduce points off your final grade. Every time you do it, we're taking points off.
Mm-hmm.
And that really helps, I think, them. Some of them complain. They say, I can't study without my laptop. But then for every one of them who tells me that, 10 of them say, I'm sitting behind these people who are online shopping, playing video games, and I can't concentrate. And so I'm like, I always tell them, I'm sure there's like one or two of you out there who would really just use your laptops to do a good job. But there's so many who would do something else that I just have to ban them.
Yeah.
So that is something I've noticed, that we're sort of just addicted to these kinds of technologies.
Yeah.
Which are distracting.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is what I study. So.
Yeah, when I'm paying attention. Let's see. How do you think your field has changed in the last 50 years or so with new technology?
50 years?
Sure.
Wow. Okay.
Has it been around that long?
sure. So, cognitive psychology and neuroscience have been around for, definitely 50 years. Let's see. So I can tell you a little bit more about, you know, I haven't been in those fields for that long, but I think one way in which things have changed has been that there's been an enormous sort of cognitive neuroscience revolution. So in the 70s, you start having positron emission tomography, and people like Stephen Coslin and others begin to ask questions like, when a human closes their eyes and imagines their mom smiling at them, is their visual cortex activating in their brain?
Yeah.
And it turns out, it's really cool. How do you pronounce your name? Zenon?
Zenon.
Zenon.
Like
Zenon.
Yep.
Zenon.
Yeah.
There's a very famous cognitive scientist named, I think it's Zenon Polishin. And
well,
Zenon Polishin.
There's another one of you out there. Look at that.
Wow.
He, and I'm not sure if he how he pronounces his name, but it's Zenon Polishin. And he had this other view than Stephen Coslin. He said, no, mental imagery is not like a picture in my brain that would activate my visual cortex. It's more propositional in nature, more linguistic, more like language.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, I might epiphenomenally experience something like a picture when I think about it, but really at its fundamental level, it's more propositional and language-like. And so Stephen Coslin came along in the 70s and started using positron emission tomography, or PET, and said, well, if I ask people to close their eyes and imagine stuff, or ask them to do tasks where they have to use some visual imagery, let's see what part of the brain activates. And it turns out it was the visual cortex. And of course, Zenon came along and said, came back and said, well, there could be reasons for that. You have to show me that the way the visual cortex activates changes with exactly what they're imagining, just like it would with exactly what a person was seeing. So we know there are different parts of the brain that are specialized, for example, for processing faces or scenes, the fusiform face area, the parahippocampal place area. And so it's been this ongoing battle. And sure enough, though, when you do those experiments, those same areas, the parahippocampal face area I'm sorry, the parahippocampal place area on the one hand for places and the fusiform face area for faces, they activate differentially when you imagine places and faces.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's been a very insightful debate, and it actually presaged the advent of functional MRI, which happens kind of in the early 90s, when, actually 1990, I think they start isolating BOLD, which is the signal, the blood oxygen level dependent signal, which functional MRI experiments track, which is essentially a measure of blood flow, like where is blood flowing in the brain. And then by the early mid 90s, you start seeing a wave of experiments in humans, which are really exploring the kind of neuroscientific basis for cognition. And this becomes the field of cognitive neuroscience. It was around even in the 70s, 80s, when Coslin, they're doing those studies, maybe a little, you know, in that time period. But I think the advent of functional MRI made it even more accessible. Many more people start doing it.
Yeah.
So that's been a huge shift. I think going from the 90s into maybe the mid-2000s and, you know, 2000s, you start seeing this. Now, people still use functional MRI, and other techniques have come into play as well, transcranial magnetic stimulation, TDCS, which is like attaching a battery to your head and
mm-hmm.
passing a card through, seeing if that does anything.
Why not? Let's just try it. Yeah.
Well, people have reasons to think it could. So there have been a lot of techniques that have come with this era. And now with the computing power expanding as it has, there's been a huge interest in things like big data. So big data, not just like get data from a billion people and, you know, doing reaction time experiments or using an app, but also how many subjects can we scan in an fMRI study, like thousands of people, and try to like make generalizations across, you know, thousands of brains and things like this.
Wow.
So the field has become more big data, more sort of technologically sophisticated.
What separates us then from the capabilities, the memory capabilities and things like that of AI?
So, you know, it's interesting because a lot of computational modeling, and I actually sat in on a great course given here by Thad Polk, who's a professor in psychology, teaches he also teaches cognitive psychology, but he has a computational modeling course. And one of the things that we learned in there was that when people build simulations of cognition, so you can program computers to simulate various cognitive abilities, some of those are aimed at trying to simulate those abilities in the same way as human brains would, you know, enact them or implement them. But other people are just saying, hey, I just want to build something that's AI that can do this. And I don't care if the way it does it isn't the same way as the way that a human does. I just want to, you know, do I know that when I tell Alexa to turn the lights off, does her, you know, way of doing that map on to how a human brain would do that? Probably not, but I guess the first answer to your question is that it depends exactly on what type of AI we're going to compare to the human. But one thing that kind of scares me a little bit is that AI will become gradually more and more able to do human-like things. And I'm not sure where morality is on the list of things to train AI.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a really important, and this gets into HAL, remember from the, what was it, 2000, A Space Odyssey, remember?
Yeah.
That movie. And then all these movies, like, you know, that get into, what was the Will Smith movies about the iRobot?
Yeah,
and these like unethical machines and things. That's something that I worry about. But I do think that, you know, computers are kind of, they have far different abilities, right? They can be much quicker in many ways than a human brain can. So yeah, I guess I don't know enough about that to really.
Okay. So then how else do you think that the study of cognition is going to progress and change over the next couple decades or so?
That's a really good question. Well, we're always refining methods. All the fields of cognition and neuroscience are, you know, using, if it's not technology, even just the way we approach questions, the experiments we run are always becoming more and more refined. I think we're starting to see, in some sense, on the one hand, more and more of a mixture of cognition and neuroscience methods. So I do think that, and computational modeling. So I think what we'll start seeing are people not just doing cognitive psychology or just doing neuroscience or just doing computational modeling, but putting those together and saying something like, I have a computational model of how a person thinks in this particular context. And I've now done some experiments, some cognitive psychology experiments with reaction time or something, and it looks like people behave in ways that are consistent with my model. And moreover, I've done some brain imaging experiments, and the way in which the brain activations vary across my conditions is exactly as would be predicted from my model too. And now I can link maybe different parts of the brain to different parts of the model to make inferences about how those brain regions contribute to these different parts of thinking.
Yeah.
And that's happening more and more already, but I think that's a growing trend in the field. I also think this big data, advanced statistical analysis, quantitative trend will grow. 20 years from now, our computing power continues to grow as well. And so I think we'll be able to do much more sophisticated analyses of kind of large scale networks in the brain. So instead of thinking about individual brain regions, we'll think about, and we still do now do this, but we'll think increasingly about networks of brain regions, how they communicate with each other. What is the role not only of each individual brain region by itself, but how does its role change as a function of what network it has to be connected to do a task? So I think things will become increasingly kind of multivariate, where we study the influences of many things and the contributions of many things on cognition.
Okay, so much more integrated approach.
I think so. To give an example, in the project that I'm collaborating on now with David Brang, we work with a neurosurgeon, Sean Hervey-Jumper at UCSF. And Sean is actually removing brain tumors, but he's also a researcher. So when people do tasks like these reaction time tasks that I've been telling you about, while they're just about before they're about to get a brain tumor removed, so the patient is lying there, they've had part of their skull removed, they've been woken up, and the surgeon comes in and they want to remove this tumor, but in the process they don't want to damage nearby healthy tissue. So you may have heard that they'll often stimulate with an electrode and say, try to talk, and if the patient can't talk anymore, they say, oh, I better not remove that brain region or damage it when I remove the tumor, because if I do, the patient won't be able to talk. Or try to move, I'll stimulate this. If you can't move your arm anymore, you know, you better not like damage that area when you remove the tumor. And in fact, they've done this in general with like musicians. Like, you know, there are certain people who like maybe they play the flute for a living, and they'll have their flute with them in the operating room playing while the surgeon is stimulating to make sure that they can still play the flute, right? So there's a lot of concerns. You know, oftentimes people think that, well, if you have a brain tumor, you're going to die anyway, so why do we have to care? You know, you can remove this tumor, you'll only live like a little while. But a lot of tumor patients actually can live for many, many, many years if the tumors are of a certain type, if they're not the most dangerous ones. And so ensuring quality of life, right, for these patients is really important. Anyway, it turns out that one thing we're trying to look at now is whether signals that we can measure from the electrodes that we place on patients' brains, do they vary with the type of tumor that's actually in the patient's brain and is nearby? And that kind of connects at a kind of, you know, or promises to have a connection between sort of a very cellular level, right? So some these tumors differ from those tumors at a very cellular level. How they interact with healthy tissue is sort of very complex or different as a function of the type of tumor. That difference might translate then into a change in the electrocorticography signal we can measure with the electrode, which might then correlate with how the patient is behaving and performing our cognitive tasks. And the ability to transcend multiple levels, like going from the cellular structure of a tumor all the way through brain activity to behavior,
yeah,
is really another kind of cool thing that I think technology is enabling.
So how has studying cognition and neuroscience influenced how you view other people in the world?
Oh, man. I think you develop an appreciation for how complex people are. It certainly helps me to appreciate how multifaceted people can be. Just as in psychology, we have memory, attention, emotion, language, and all these different aspects. And just as a student, for example, can be really good at some subjects and not others, people are tremendously multifaceted. And so as a cognitive psychologist or a neuroscientist, I think I've come to appreciate more and more how specialized different human abilities are, and that I can be talking to somebody who's great at one thing, but that doesn't mean they're great at everything, for example. Also, other people are a relief, because sometimes it gets really, you know, overwhelming, and, you know, you're doing all this work and everything. And sometimes I'm just like, I got to go talk to some people. You know?
So I guess, finally, what's one thing that maybe you would go back in time and tell your undergraduate self?
It's something I've tried to do, and it's probably the most important thing that I would advise people as they move forward, but is stay close to your passion. I had friends who kind of were going into fields like accounting, and who later got really bored with their careers. And it wasn't just accounting, but that's just one of them. And I mentioned before, I was changing my major to psychology. I actually wound up with 2 degrees, but I added psychology late, and that was going to cause me to stay for an extra year. And my friends were like, you could make money now, just leave. And I thought, no, but I need to be passionate. I need to be really interested in what I'm doing. So I think what advice I would give to myself, if I could go back in time and say, you know, don't worry so much about what other people think. Worry about, are you happy? Worry about, like, are you doing what's really cool? And don't be afraid to ask for permission, because if you don't ask, you'll never get to do what you want.
Yeah.
So I think that's a couple of pieces of advice.
Yeah. That's great advice. Thank you.
Yep. Yeah. Thank you very much for sitting here and talking with us about cognition and neuroscience and all related things. We appreciate it.
Yes, this is an excellent interview. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
A big, huge thank you to Dr. Daniel Weissman of the University of Michigan. We had such a fun time talking to you. We also have a Facebook page now. Make sure you check that out. Get a little glimpse into how we make this all come together. We've got a Twitter, and we have an email as well. If you think of any referrals or, you know, somebody you think we should talk to.
Yep. And all of these things are in the show notes right at the bottom. So check them out. Give us a like, follow, email visit, and we'll be doing good. And if you're listening on iTunes, please stop by, give us a rating, a review, anything helps.
Yeah, so thank you to you guys for listening, and we'll see you next time on Preoccupied.
Okay.
I like penguins.
Yeah, penguins are good.